You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Healing Process, Spirit, Nature, and Our Bodies, given in 1923 and 1924. Lecture number one is entitled Healing Methods Based on Spiritual Science, given in Penmanmar in England on August 28, 1923. I am very glad to be able to spend an evening accommodating your wish to hear about the therapeutic principles that have been developed on the basis of the anthroposophical worldview. It is difficult, however, to speak briefly on a subject that encompasses so much. At best, a single short lecture can be no more than aphoristic, and barely suffices to communicate the important points accurately. In addition, such a lecture entails certain observations that are, necessarily, somewhat far removed from normal consciousness. I will, nonetheless, attempt tonight to make the important points as accessible as possible. The medical school of thought within the anthroposophical movement certainly did not come about because we anthroposophists want to be everywhere at once and stick our noses into everything. That is certainly not the case. But as the anthroposophical movement attempted to make its way in the world, its membership grew to include, among others, a number of physicians who were seriously seeking the truth. Quite a few of these professionals became conscious, with varying degrees of clarity, of weaknesses in the views of today's officially recognized medicine, and realized that medicine, having chosen to take the modern, conventional natural sciences as its sole basis, often lacks the foundations for a real understanding of disease processes and cures. Our conventional natural sciences, in turn, are on firm ground only when dealing with discoveries that can be made in the external natural world by mechanical, physical, or chemical means. All that physics and chemistry discover about natural processes is then applied to understanding human beings, who in fact contain a microcosmic concentration of all the world's processes. Physical and chemical processes, however, never take the same form within the human body itself as they do in the natural world outside it. The earthly substances we take in are not mere passive substances, but are always imbued with natural processes. To outer view, a substance appears to be simply at rest within itself, but in reality all kinds of processes act and interact in it. Thus these processes, these natural, physical, and chemical actions and interactions, are also taken into the human body. Once there, however, they are immediately transformed. We can understand how natural processes are transformed within the human organism only by truly learning to observe human beings. By choosing to base itself exclusively on physics and chemistry, today's science, however, ignores the specifically human factor in the actions taking place inside the human being. Nothing that takes place in the physical human body, for example, does so without being simultaneously influenced by etheric processes, astral processes, and the I processes. But because science disregards all of these suprasensory actions and interactions, it cannot really approach human beings as such. It cannot see inside human beings, either healthy or sick, in a way that allows it to recognize exactly how external chemical and physical processes continue to work there. How are we supposed to assess the effect of a remedy if we cannot understand the action of a natural substance that is introduced into the body or used to treat the body in some way? We can say, then, that in recent times the greatest medical advances have occurred in the field of surgery, which deals with physical procedures that are more or less mechanical. In contrast to the state of the art in surgery, when it comes to actual treatment, and this is not my opinion, but that of physicians who have become aware of this problem, confusion reigns because prevailing views on natural science exclude the essentially human factor from scientific observation, making it impossible to see the connection between a natural substance and its effect on an illness. By attempting to understand the inner nature of the human being as both supra-sensible and physical, anthroposophy can also yield insight into the use of various natural remedies in treating human illness. Today we confront certain fundamental limits of medical science if we so much as inquire about the actual nature of illness. What is illness? Modern scientific knowledge cannot answer this question at all. According to scientific views, all the processes that take place in a healthy human being are natural processes from head to toe. But in that case, what are the processes that take place during illness in the human liver, kidneys, head, heart, or anywhere else? They too are natural processes. All healthy processes are natural processes, and all disease processes are also natural processes. Then how can a person be well under the influence of an activity of one sort and ill under the influence of another? The point here is to avoid speaking in vague and general terms. To say that healthy natural processes are normal while diseased natural processes are not is to merely use a handy phrase that comes to mind when we do not understand what we are talking about. Quote, "Do not plague yourself too anxiously, for just where no ideas are, the proper word is never far." Close quote from Goethe's Faust. It is important to note that whenever we apply only modern conventional science, we deal with corpses rather than with living human beings. We take pieces from the body here and there and imagine the healthy or diseased natural processes that take place in them. In this approach, it really makes no difference whether we take tissue from the head or the liver or the big toe, because in the end it all comes down to cells. Histology, the study of tissues, has gradually become the most highly developed area of knowledge about the human being. Indeed, if you consider the smallest parts and leave out all the interacting forces, all human organs are the same, just as all cows are gray at night. The result, however, is a nocturnal gray cow science, not a true science, that deals with specific human organs and their differences. Although I have been studying the necessary foundations of a specific science of the human body for 30 to 35 years, I have dared to speak about them only in the past few years. People usually believe that spiritual science achieves its results very easily. In contrast to the physical world, where real work in laboratories or clinics is required, people imagine that you simply need to look into the spiritual world in order to find everything you need. It is obvious that physical research takes effort, but it is assumed that scientists of the spirit simply look into the world of the spirit and everything is revealed to them. That is what people think, but it is not true. Conscientious spiritual research takes more effort and above all more responsibility than working in a laboratory, clinic, or observatory. Although it is true that the first conception of what I will outline briefly tonight was available to me 35 years ago, I was able to state its principles only a few years ago, after I had assimilated it thoroughly and checked it against the totality of accepted modern science. Footnote, see Riddles of the Soul, Collected Works, number 21, end of footnote. The therapeutic stream within our anthroposophical movement, which I mentioned earlier, came about under the auspices of these principles governing the subdivision of the human body. When we look at the physical human body, we must distinguish three different members which may be given various names. It is easiest to approach them, however, by characterizing them as follows. One system in the physical human being is the sensory nervous system, which is localized primarily in the head. The second is the rhythmic system, which includes not only respiration and blood circulation, but also rhythmical digestive functions and so on. The third human member consists of the connection between the motoric system of the limbs and the metabolic system. This connection will become clear to you immediately if you think about how limb movement promotes metabolism. Also, when we continue into the body in the direction indicated by the limbs, we find metabolic organs. Anatomy reveals this close association. Just consider how the legs and also the arms continue inside the human body in the metabolic organs. Thus we can distinguish three members of the human being: the sensory nervous system, localized primarily in the head, the rhythmic system, found predominantly in the chest, around the heart, and the metabolic limb system, encompassing principally the limbs and the adjacent metabolic organs. We must not imagine this subdivision of the human being as crudely as it was described by one professor who was trying to give anthroposophy a bad name, footnote Professor Hugo Fuchs of Göttingen, end of footnote. He made no attempt to understand the deeper meaning of this subdivision, but simply denounced it, saying that anthroposophists claim that the human being consists of three systems, the head, the torso, and the limbs. This is a quick and easy way to make the subject look ridiculous. In fact, stating that the sensory nervous system is present only in the head misses the point. The sensory nervous system is located primarily in the head, but spreads out from there over the entire body, so that the organizing principle of the human head extends over the entire organism. The rhythmic system also spreads out, both upward and downward, to encompass the entire organism. In a spatial sense, therefore, it can be said that the human being is all rhythmic system, or all metabolic limb system. For example, your eyes act as limbs when you move them. These members interpenetrate rather than exist alongside one another in space. We must accustom ourselves to thinking a bit more precisely if we want to assess this subdivision of the human being in the right way. The first and third systems, the sensory nervous system and the metabolic limb system, are polar opposites. Anything one of these systems creates, the other destroys. Their functions are complete opposites. The middle system, the rhythmic system, establishes the connection between the other two. It constantly oscillates between them, so to speak, harmonizing the destructive action of one system with the productive action of the other. For example, the metabolic system functions at peak intensity in the human abdomen, of course. If a person is to remain healthy, however, anything that happens in the abdomen must elicit its polar opposite activity in the head, in the sensory nervous system. Now imagine that the activity of the human digestive system becomes so intense that it extends all the way up into the sensory nervous system. That is, a function that ought to take place in the metabolic organization encroaches on the sensory nervous system. There you have two natural processes, if you will, but it is obvious that one of them becomes abnormal. Instead of staying in the metabolic system where it belongs, it breaks through into the sensory nervous system. This phenomenon leads to migraine, an illness that tends to be downplayed by modern medicine, but not by a large portion of humanity, since the various forms of this illness are ubiquitous. In order to understand the different forms of this illness, we must realize that an intense process that is meant to take place in the metabolism breaks through into the sensory nervous system. The metabolism shoots into the nerves and senses instead of staying where it belongs. The opposite can also occur. A process that is supposed to be at its most intense in the sensory nervous system, one that is the exact opposite of the metabolic activity, can break through into the metabolic system. A heightened sensory nervous process takes place in the metabolic system, where only very minor sensory nervous processes are ordinarily found. A function that belongs in the head breaks through into the abdomen. This phenomenon triggers the dangerous illness known as typhoid fever in human beings. A fundamental understanding of the threefold human being shows us how a healthy process develops into a disease process in the human organism. If the human head and its sensory nervous system were organized differently, we would never get typhoid fever. If the human abdomen were structured differently, we would never get migraines. But the head activity is meant to stay in the head, and abdominal activity in the abdomen. If they extend into the opposite pole of the body, illnesses such as these come about. These two illnesses are especially characteristic, but there are also others that arise because a specific activity belonging to a specific organ system exerts its influence somewhere else, in a different organ system. If we proceed from the perspective of anatomy alone, we can see how the smallest parts are incorporated into body tissues, but we cannot see the effects of polar opposite activities. All you can tell from studying a neuron is that its structure is the exact opposite of that of a liver cell, for example. But when you are able to study the totality of the human body, so that its threefold character becomes apparent, you also discover that in order to remain healthy, a neuron constantly wants to disintegrate or break down, whereas a liver cell wants to be built up. These activities are polar opposites. They interact in the right way when they occupy their appropriate places in the organism, and they interact in the wrong way when they force their way into each other. The rhythmic system stands in the middle and always attempts to bring about a balance between the polar opposite functions of the sensory nervous system and the metabolic limb system. At this point, I would like to select a specific example. Although I will be able to discuss it only briefly, it may offer insight into how we can discover the connection between the forces of a remedy derived from nature and the forces of healing or disease at work within the human being. Let's look at a particular ore, naturally occurring antimony ore. Even to superficial observation, antimony reveals an extraordinary characteristic. Antimony occurs naturally in the form of roughly parallel spikes or rods. The crystals grow almost like mineral moss or lichen. We can see that this mineral tends to assume thread-like shapes. When the ore is subjected to a specific physical-chemical process, this tendency becomes even more pronounced, and the thread-like shapes become even thinner. Even more significant, however, is what happens when antimony is subjected to a combustion of sorts. The white smoke that forms may condense on surfaces where it becomes shiny and reflective. This phenomenon, known as the antimony mirror, is mostly disregarded today, but it was used a great deal in the school of medicine based on ancient forces of cognition, which I mentioned several times in the morning lectures. Footnote: see the extensive note at the end of this lecture. The morning lectures referred to are titled The Evolution of Consciousness, end of footnote. And I will read that extension about the antimony mirror at the end of this lecture. Continue reading. This antimony mirror, which develops only as a result of combustion, and which can form reflective deposits on surfaces, is extraordinarily important. In addition, antimony has another characteristic that I want to emphasize. If antimony is placed on the cathode during certain electrolytic processes, only a slight influence is required to create a little explosion. In short, antimony possesses very interesting properties. The results of taking a moderate dose of antimony demonstrate what happens when the forces that I have just described extend into the human body. I want to outline the inner connection briefly, although I cannot discuss all the details and proofs. In the human organism, the effects of antimony are especially apparent wherever blood clots. These effects intensify and promote the clotting of blood. But when we investigate this phenomenon using methods that also apply to the threefold subdivision of the human organism, methods that gradually allow us to develop insight into the nature of the human being and the relationships among the individual systems in various organs, we find that the active living principle in any form of antimony, not just naturally occurring mineral antimony, is actually a complex of forces that is also active in the healthy human body. In the diseased human body, it also takes on the forms I described. The polar opposite of the antimony process in the human organism appears wherever sculpturally active forces shape or round off cells. That is, wherever the actual cellular substance of the human organism is forming. Because these forces are primarily present in proteins, I will call them the proteinizing forces, or proteinizing forces. Within the human organism, therefore, we have not only the natural forces that we discover in antimony when we subject it to combustion, causing an antimony mirror to form, but also the opposite forces, the proteinizing forces that arrest or eliminate the antimony forces. These two systems, the proteinizing and the antimonizing forces, counteract each other and must achieve a certain balance in a human organism. At this point, we must recognize that the process I described earlier as the basis of typhoid fever, for example, is essentially due to a disturbance in the balance between these two forces. In order to truly see into the human organism, we must enlist the help of the admittedly non-medical perspectives I have presented in the morning lectures, running concurrent with this course. In these lectures, we saw that each human being has not only a physical body, but also an etheric body, or body of formative forces, an astral body, and an eye organization. Yesterday, I explained that there is an intimate connection between the physical body and the body of formative forces, as is also the case with the eye being and the astral body. While the connection between the astral body and the etheric body, or body of formative forces, is looser, since these two bodies separate each night. This connection, which consists of an interplay of astral and etheric forces, is radically disturbed in typhoid fever. In typhoid, the astral body becomes weak and cannot work into the physical body with enough intensity. The human sensory nervous organization, which is primarily subject to the astral body, is forced downward by the imbalance that results when the astral body is busy with its own affairs. Instead of being transformed in the metabolism, the sensory nervous system remains present in the form of astral activity. Because the astral body is active on its own behalf and is not working into the ether body in the right way, symptoms typical of typhoid fever develop. To a certain extent, antimony's spiky crystals and the antimony bloom that appears like frost ferns on a cold window belie the mineral nature of antimony. The crystallizing force that is active in antimony, if appropriately formulated and administered to the human organism in the form of a remedy, helps the organism reinsert the astral body and its forces into the etheric body in the right way, restoring an appropriate connection between these bodies. By using a remedy produced from antimony, we support the opposite of the typhoid process. We can use this remedy to stimulate and support activities within the organism that develop its own antimonizing forces, which in turn act to bring about the right rhythmical interaction between the etheric body and the astral body. Depending on the course the illness takes, the remedy may also need to include other substances that are similarly related to the human organism. Anthroposophical observations show us the relationship between forces active outside in nature in natural substances, such as the antimony in our example, and those at work inside the human organism. Both the proteinizing forces, which sculpts rounded shapes, and the force that works in a linear manner can be traced right into the germ cell. It is unpleasant to say that what I must say next, knowing that it will elicit aversion on the part of some people. Nonetheless, to anyone who has truly acquired insights into the workings of the human organism, the most wonderful microscopic investigations of the ovum or germ cell seem extraordinarily amateurish. People are content with superficial observation of the ovum as such and the development of the so-called centrioles. You can look this up in any embryology text, and do not realize that the effects of the proteinizing forces that also govern the entire organism are the polar opposites of the effects of the antimonizing forces. The round shape of the ovum itself is brought about by proteinizing forces. After insemination, the centrioles are created by antimonizing processes. Such processes, however, are going on throughout the human body. If we prepare remedies in the right way, and if our diagnosis tells us where we must support the human organism, we can provide it with the forces it needs to counteract a disease process. When we introduce anthroposophical perspectives into the study of medicine, we consider the correct relationship of the macrocosm, the entire cosmos, to the human being. I would have had to say much more in order to describe all the scientific details with regard to antimony and the inherent principles that emanate from it, but I am simply trying to present the most salient aspects. In a similar way, I can also point out how another substance, quartz, for instance, behaves in the natural processes. The mineral we call quartz or silica, silicea, I can't find a pronunciation for this, S-I-L-I-C-E-A, silicea, silicea, which is one of the components of granite. I'm sorry, that's me, the reader, speaking. Apologize. Let me read that again. The mineral we call quartz or silica, silicea, which is one of the components of granite, takes the form of transparent crystals that are so hard they cannot be scratched with a knife. A diagnosis-specific dose of correctly formulated silica supports the forces of the sensory nervous system as they are meant to develop in the organism. A remedy prepared from quartz or silica supports what the senses are meant to do. Depending on the patient's secondary symptoms, other substances will also need to be included in the preparation, but the most important factor in this case is the effect of the silica formative process. When introduced into the human organism, the activity of silica supports weakened sensory nervous activity and brings it up to the appropriate level of intensity. When sensory nervous activity becomes too weak, digestive activity extends forcefully into the head, and migraine-like conditions ensue. If we reinforce sensory nervous functions in the right way with a remedy that has been correctly prepared from quartz or silica, the migraine sufferer's sensory nervous system will become strong enough to force back the digestive process that has invaded the head. Of course, my descriptions of these phenomena are somewhat general, but they will allow you to grasp the most important issue, namely that in order to seek out the natural substances capable of combating specific disease processes in the human organism, we need real insight into the healthy and diseased human organism, not only with regard to the makeup of its cells, but also with regard to the forces working within it, parenthesis, in harmony, in polarity, or rhythmically, close parenthesis. For example, we discover that introducing the process inherent in naturally occurring phosphorus into the human organism corrects a specific inner weakness. In a healthy human organism, a kind of organic combustion must always be active when substances are being transformed. Phosphorus exerts a corrective influence when the organism has too little strength to allow these forces of combustion to work properly. Organic combustion occurs with every movement we make, including inner movements. Sometimes the human organism becomes too weak to regulate these organic combustion processes, which need to be curbed in the right way. If left unchecked, they develop too strongly. Their inherent intensity is boundless. If it were not, we would immediately succumb to excessive fatigue or no longer be able to move at all. The organism must always be able to curb the boundless intensity of these processes, however. When the forces needed to restrain organic combustion are not present, either in the entire organism or in a single organ system, various forms of tuberculosis develop. Inability of the organs to restrain combustion simply creates a suitable medium for the tuberculosis bacillus. It is not my intention here to say anything against germ theory, which in fact is very useful. The appearance of different bacilli in different locations is very informative, especially with respect to diagnosis. I do not want to take a stand against official medicine. We must simply move beyond the limits of that school of thought, and we can do so by applying anthroposophical perspectives. If we administer phosphorus, we support the ability to curb organic combustion processes. We must consider, however, that the restraining effect can emanate from different organ systems. If it emanates from the system that works primarily in the bones, we must strengthen the effects of phosphorus in the body by making them bone-specific, so to speak. We do this by combining the phosphorus remedy with calcium or calcium salts, using a method that a more precise study of the matter will reveal. If we are dealing with tuberculosis of the small intestines, we will have to mix the phosphorus with appropriate doses of copper compounds of some sort. And in cases of tuberculosis of the lungs, we will have to add iron to the phosphorus. Under certain circumstances, additional ingredients may also need to be considered, since pulmonary tuberculosis is an extremely complicated illness. As you see, the possibility of true therapy is based on the further effects of chemical and physical processes inside the human organism. Official medicine often proceeds on the supposition that the effects of the forces of antimony, for example, remain the same inside the human organism as they are outside it. This is not the case. We must understand clearly how these forces behave when they extend into the human organism. This understanding is possible if we apply anthroposophical knowledge to the relevant experiments. With regard to antimony and its forces, we see that antimony reestablishes the rhythm between the astral body and the etheric body, or body of formative forces. Similarly, we can see that the forces at work in quartz or silica are especially suited to correcting a disturbed relationship between the I-being and the astral body, thus exerting a healing effect on the sensory nervous system. And calcium compounds, especially calcium compounds excreted by animals, yield remedies that establish the right relationship between the body of formative forces and the physical body. Thus, looking at the human being in the right way leads us to use calcium or calcium-like substances, especially substances like oyster shell that have been excreted by animals, to correct an imbalance between the etheric body and the physical body that results in a physical disease. When the body of formative forces and the astral body interact arrhythmically, we must turn to forces that are present not only in antimony, for example, but also in many other metals and in substances found especially in the middle portions of plants, that is, the leaves and stems. In contrast, the forces corresponding to phosphorus are primarily present in the flowering organs of plants, while forces corresponding to silica are found in the roots. You see, we can discover the human being's relationship to forces present in different parts of the plant. Root forces have a distinct relationship to the human head and sensory nervous system. The leaf and stem have a particular connection to the rhythmic system. Flowering organs to the abdominal or metabolic system. Therefore, if we have diagnosed correctly and want to find a simple way to help the digestive or metabolic system, simply choosing the right flowers and making a tea of them is often sufficient. In contrast, root salts must be extracted according to a specific procedure in order to yield a remedy that works primarily on the sensory nervous system and the organs of the head. Once we are able to understand nature on the one hand and the human organism on the other, we will truly be able to discover natural remedies. Seeing the relationship between nature and the human being, and the human body, makes it unnecessary to conduct clinical tests to determine the effects of potential remedies. Such tests, as you know, document a series of cases in which favorable results are achieved in perhaps 90% or 70%, with unfavorable results in the remaining cases. The results are analyzed statistically, and the test substance is considered medically effective or not, depending on the statistical outcome. If we proceed in a strictly scientific manner, and without succumbing to dilettantism or medical sectarianism, it is indeed possible to get the better of disease processes, to get the better of disease processes by using remedies developed from the human perspective. Unfortunately, I can discuss these issues only briefly and aphoristically today. Methods of administering remedies are as important as recognizing the right natural substances and processes to be made into remedies. Because we must work on individual systems, either the sensory nervous, the rhythmic, or the metabolic limb system, in order to bring about healing, it is important and even essential to know the appropriate method of administration. Almost any remedy can be used in three different ways. If it is administered via the mouth and stomach, we count on influencing the metabolic system, and in turn that system's effect on the others. Some remedies, therefore, should generally be administered orally. Other remedies, such as antimony, however, must be used in a way that permits them to work on the rhythmic system. At this point, we see the need for administering remedies by injection. We count on remedies that are administered intravenously or injected in some other way to work on the human being's rhythmic process. We rely on remedies or therapeutic processes that are applied to the human body from outside, either substances administered in the form of baths and ointments or outer mechanical therapies, such as massage and the like, to affect the sensory nervous system. We can also approach healing from any one of the three systems. Let's take the example of silica or quartz. It is a different remedy when formulated with oral administration in mind than when it is intended for injection. If we administer it orally, we want the digestive system to assimilate the remedy and direct the quartz to the sensory nervous system. That is, the quartz activity we introduce detours through the digestive system. But if we want these forces to be conveyed to the sensory nervous system via the blood and the rhythm of respiration to take advantage of the healing effect of rhythm, we administer the silica by injection. If certain aromatic, etheric substances, such as those in flowers, are meant to act on the digestive organs, we prepare a tea that is taken by mouth so that it goes into the stomach. But we may want an etheric oil to act on the sensory nervous system directly through its aroma, or we may want it to affect rhythmical activity by way of the sensory nervous system. In these instances, we work on the nerves and senses by adding a fluid extract of the flowers to a bath. As you can see, the therapeutic effects that substances develop in relationship to the human being depend on how these substances are administered. All of these issues will become apparent only when anthroposophical knowledge is increasingly applied to the connection between natural effects and the human being. that is, when anthroposophy informs our choice of remedies and methods of administration. To make progress along these lines, some physicians who have become members of our movement have established anthroposophical clinics, therapeutic institutes, laboratories, and other facilities that produce remedies and test both remedies and therapeutic methods. We have both clinical and pharmaceutical facilities in Arlesheim, near Dornach, and in Stuttgart. At this juncture, I particularly want to mention the Clinical Therapeutic Institute in Arlesheim and its excellent director, Dr. Wegmann, whose valuable activity on behalf of this institute has been made possible by her own courage to heal, as I would like to call it. Footnote: the Clinical Therapeutic Institute in Arlesheim, now the Ita Wegmann Clinic, was founded in 1920 and directed by Dr. Ita Wegmann, 1876 to 1943. Dr. Wegmann was born in the Dutch East Indies. She trained in therapeutic gymnastics, massage, and medicine, later becoming head of the medical section of the Anthroposophical Society. With Rudolf Steiner, she wrote Extending Practical Medicine, Fundamental Principles Based on the Science of the Spirit, Collected Works, Volume 27, London, Rudolf Steiner Press, 1966, previously published as titled Fundamentals of Therapy, end of footnote. Healing takes courage. It takes courage to explore, on the one hand, the complexity of natural processes from which therapeutic processes are derived, and on the other hand, the extreme complexity of processes of health and disease in the human being. Facing the immensity of this field, and you always face it, even if you have only a limited number of patients, requires the courage to heal. The Institute in Arlesheim is associated with our International Pharmaceutical Laboratory, where remedies are produced. Footnote: International Pharmaceutical Laboratory, now Valeda AG, located in Arlesheim, parent company, and Schwäbisch Gmünd factory, and its subsidiaries, end of footnote. If the appropriate ways and means are found, these remedies can be made available today throughout the world. People must discover this laboratory and about how to get these remedies. Our work is professional, and we are not repudiating modern science, but simply elaborating on it. Once this insight matures in the broadest possible circles, there will be no need for concern about the success of an undertaking such as the International Pharmaceutical Laboratory in Arlesheim. Because our method of therapy and its remedies are based on a holistic understanding of the human being, however, it is difficult to show them off to their full advantage, given today's purely materialistic tendencies. We are dependent on the insight of individuals who take the health of their fellow human beings to heart. Although I first wanted to point out what can be achieved through the appropriate use of natural remedies, using them by no means excludes more soul-spiritual healing work. Especially fruitful observations can be made in this area. When the element of hygiene and therapy is brought into schools, as always happens in true pedagogy, we discover that the way we teach and our soul-spiritual effects on the children can have a great variety of healing or disease-producing consequences, perhaps not immediately, but certainly later on in the students' lives. Parenthesis: my lectures on education explain the issues involved. Close parenthesis. Let me mention just one example. With regard to a child's memory, the right thing for teachers to do is to ask neither too much nor too little of it. If teachers lack pedagogical sensitivity, however, and demand too much of the children's memory between the ages of 7 and 10, the excessive remembering that is artificially cultivated in the children's souls will be played out in later life in the form of all sorts of physical illnesses. It is possible to prove a direct connection between diabetes and inappropriate use of memorization in teaching. It is equally true, however, that disturbing a child's memory in the other direction can also have negative effects. It is getting so late that I can mention only the principles behind these issues. But you see that natural remedies are not the only way to influence health and illness. The particular way the soul itself works is also important. This principle allows us to make the transition to methods that attempt to bring about healing through the purely soul-spiritual influences of one person on another. Lack of time prevents me from describing these methods in detail. Let me just say, however, that it is especially easy to succumb to dilettantism in this field. We may believe, for example, that so-called mental illnesses are the easiest to heal through spiritual influences. In such illnesses, however, it is typically very difficult to get through to patients on the soul-spiritual level, because their souls shut themselves off from outer influences. So-called mental illnesses do not deserve that name. We will always discover physical disease processes hidden somewhere. Before we amateurishly intercede in cases of mental illness, we should correctly diagnose the physical focus of the illness, which is sometimes deeply hidden. Curing the physical organism in the appropriate way will then prove very helpful. We are much more likely to be able to alleviate physical illness by means of all kinds of soul-spiritual influences, although at present most of them are implemented in very superficial ways, an issue I do not want to go into now. In the case of physical ailments in particular, a great deal of benefit can accrue from this kind of support for the process that is meant to be brought about through medications and the like. I can point only briefly to this issue now. Methods based on anthroposophy certainly include rather than exclude soul-spiritual therapeutic influences, as is demonstrated by the fact that the Clinical Therapeutic Institute in Arlesheim-Dornach uses curative eurythmy in addition to physical methods of healing. Curative eurythmy is a transformed version of how people move their limbs in the artistic eurythmy you have seen here. The patient performs healthy movements that are derived from eurythmy. Transformed eurythmical bowel movements are used to support the forces that I described earlier as proteinizing forces, while the consonants often bolster the antimonizing forces. The balance between these two types of forces can be supported through the interaction of consonants and vowels in curative eurythmy. This therapy, if implemented in the right way, offers significant reinforcement for other therapeutic procedures, especially in cases of chronic illness. Curative eurythmy is based on the fact that soul-spiritual processes are aroused by what a person does with his or her physical limbs. If we know which movements proceed directly from the healthy human organism, we can also discover the corresponding movements that have therapeutic effects when human limb movement works back on the functions of inner organs. The Clinical Therapeutic Institute in Arlesheim offers possibilities to experience curative eurythmy and ways of using it in therapy derived from a real anthroposophically based understanding of the human being. It would take us too far to go into detail, but I have presented the general principles tonight. We were obliged to develop a therapeutic stream within the anthroposophical movement because medical professionals approached us in a variety of ways. This therapeutic stream was born out of the circumstances of our time. It was demanded by modern civilization, as it were. Anthroposophy simply provided answers to questions directed toward it. Today I have been able to explain the principles only aphoristically. It was not possible to do more in the time available, and I have already talked too long. If I wanted to cover even a single point in its entirety, I would have to do something that I also chose not to do in the eurythmy lecture the day before yesterday. I would have to ask you to spend the night here and listen to me until it was time for the morning lecture to begin. To do this would be conducive to illness, and someone who claims to be speaking about healing cannot make people sick in this way. I really must cut my explanation short and send you home for a good, healthy night's sleep. And that is the end of Lecture 1, and there is an appendix from page 8 of this book. If this statement, and this has to do with the antimony discussion of the mirror, it's a bit long here, I'm going to read the whole thing, but the lecture is over. If this statement were taken literally, in the chemical sense, it would not be correct, because no reflective film can be produced as a result of oxidized smoke. In chemical terms, what happens is this. When antimony, either as a metal or in the form of an ore such as antimonite, is mixed with zinc and a strong acid such as hydrochloric acid, the compound that forms is antimony hydride, SbH3. If ignited in the presence of oxygen, this compound burns, forming a white smoke of antimony trioxide, which can precipitate on cold surfaces to form the so-called antimony bloom, flores antimoniae. This antimony trioxide film is either flat white or sparkling and crystalline, not reflective. The, in quotes, antimony mirror, as Steiner mentions it, appears when oxygen is excluded. As was already mentioned, it does not form out of white oxidized smoke, but out of non-oxidized antimony vapor. To create a reflective precipitate from the oxidized smoke, it would have to be reduced, that is, oxygen would have to be removed. Such a process, however, is not the one Steiner is talking about here, but it is possible to capture the antimony that has not yet been oxidized, removing it from the white smoke by holding a chilled glass beaker very close to the flame. In this case, a metallic reflective layer of pure antimony forms on the beaker. See footnote the Marsh test for the presence of arsenic. Footnote, a simple and reliable test that can detect the presence of minute amounts of arsenic is the Marsh test, named for its inventor, English chemist James Marsh, 1794 to 1846. The substance to be tested is placed in a hydrogen generator, and any arsenic present is converted to arsine, ASH3, which mixes with the evolved hydrogen. If the stream of hydrogen is heated as it passes through a glass tube, the arsine decomposes and metallic arsenic is deposited in the tube. Minute amounts cause an appreciable stain. As little as 0.1 milligrams of arsenic or antimony can be detected in this way. End of footnote. Continuing the appendix, the antimony that has not yet combined with oxygen precipitates out of the smoke, forming a reflective film on the beaker. Under these circumstances, white smoke is present and condensation occurs on surfaces where it becomes shiny and reflective. Steiner seems to be pointing to a process here. Just as the physical human body is an opaque medium that is a prerequisite to clear thinking, so too the white smoke is the prerequisite to the formation of the gleaming metallic mirror. And just as thinking comes about through overcoming physical forces, especially gravity, the mirror arises through resistance to opacity. If we succeed in preventing the formation of smoke as it comes about, the mirror is created. The mirror is created from the ore through a type of will expressed as chemistry, which allows the antimony to appear on a level related to plant life. Today, antimony mirrors are produced primarily by distilling antimony in a vacuum. An earlier method involved thermal decomposition of antimony hydride. Because both methods exclude oxygen, they do not produce smoke. But if no smoke is present, creation cannot be prevented, and thus the smoke is the prerequisite to creating the mirror. Footnote, Rudolf Steiner also spoke about antimony in title Extending Practical Medicine, Collected Works, No. 27, co-written with Dr. Ida Wegman, in Chapter 16. And that is the end now of the Lecture 1 of the Healing Process, including the appendix.